both of the songs we just sung. Initially, when picked those, I thought we'd be in chapter 4, and we're not, but they work really well with this morning's text, particularly verse 26. It says, "The Lord will be your confidence and will keep your foot from being caught." It's the fact that he's the Ancient of Days and the grace that we've experienced in him that gives that meaning, gives it significance that he would keep our foot. In the Gospels, Jesus was asked by Pharisees who were seeking to kind of trip him up a very important question, one that didn't come from very wise motives, but a good question nonetheless. And they asked him, "Teacher, what's the greatest commandment in the law?" And he replied that you should love the Lord your God with all of your heart, soul, and with all of your mind. That's the first and greatest commandment. And then he gave a second, and the second is like unto it, or similar to it, that you should love your neighbor as yourself. And then Jesus says that on those two commandments hang all of the law and all of the prophets. So the Old Testament hangs on those ideas. It's reduced to that. So the greatest and highest of God's righteous requirements are total bodied devotion and love to Yahweh, which cascades into the second, which is generous love to the people around us. Lecture 4 in Proverbs chapter 3 encapsulates those ideas pretty well. In fact, if you just look with me in overview fashion, look at the three kind of movements in the text. The first one is this idea of total personal devotion, which is motivated by God's promise of divine security. Get that going for you. Observe with me on the black screen. There we go. Okay, so this first section, 21 through 26, really. Look at all of the pronouns used here. "My son, let them not depart from your eyes. Keep sound wisdom and discretion. So they will be life to your soul and grace to your neck. Then you will walk safely in your way, and your foot will not stumble. When you lie down, you will not be afraid. Yes, you will lie down, and your sleep will be sweet." In verse 26, "For the Lord will be your confidence and will keep your foot from being caught." It's very personalized, isn't it? It's about the son. It's about his devotion to Yahweh. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. And that's the idea in 21. Don't let these things depart from you. So you see that idea. But then there's an effect of wise people in the community. The effect of that devotion in the society. Loving neighbors is the idea. So look at 27 through 31, and it completely shifts, doesn't it? "Don't withhold good from those to whom it is due. Don't say to your neighbor. Don't devise evil against your neighbor. Don't strive with a man without cause. Don't envy the oppressor." It's all of these other relationships that are present. He's no longer referring to the son in his person. He's referring to the son's activity in the community. And then there's a motivating conclusion in 32 through 35, and that is God's own activity. What God thinks, what he promises, what he's going to do. And there are two strong categories and two very different types of activities that God is going to engage in, depending upon which category one finds themselves in. That is the wise and the fools. So that's really where the text goes this morning. If you're looking for a propositional statement to write down, it's this. In this lecture, the father forbids the wise son from forsaking wisdom either personally or publicly, and motivates him with the assurance of Yahweh's favor. There's two pieces to it. The father forbids the wise son from forsaking wisdom. You must not forsake it, either personally or in the community, right? Either personally or publicly. And the second piece is that he motivates him with the assurance of Yahweh's favor. Let's seek the Lord's help and ask for his guidance in word of prayer. Father, thank you for the opportunity again to open your word. I do pray for clarity of tongue and earnest ears, that you would please, by your Spirit, speak to your people. And for those who are not your people, we ask that the wind of the Holy Spirit would blow and that he would concern them, the fact that they may be in the category of fool and incur curse. Pray that you would warm our hearts to your truth and your love. Help us to clearly understand this text. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so the first piece, the benefits of wisdom to the Son, which is 21 through 26, or the idea of personal devotion. Okay, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind. The first command here, and you see all of the commands in red, they're all negative today. They're all restrictive. Don't do this, don't do that, don't do this. And here he starts out, don't let wisdom go away. Don't let it depart from your eyes. And all of the ideas that we're seeing in these first 2 to 3 verses are repetitive ideas that we've already seen. In fact, even when you start out a lecture, you're kind of like, okay, here we go again. We've heard some of this stuff. But what stuck out to me this week in study is this idea of retaining, keeping, guarding, hanging on for dear life. When he says, keep sound wisdom, he's saying, retain these time-tested ideas that when embraced or internalized, personalized, they grant success and help to the one who holds them. Keep before you discretion. This idea of a private thought world, whereby you are discerning right and wrong very carefully in the way that God has designed. It's a helpful tool in fighting against temptation when all of these voices are coming at you and propositions are coming at you, and you're able, even before you speak, in your own heart and your mind, to assess and to think in the way that God would think about these things that lay before you. Keep wisdom in front of you. Let them not depart. And what that instructs us in is this. The teachings have a tendency to slip away. Wisdom wants to go, or we want wisdom to go. And they can only be retained with intention and with resolution. Yesterday, I was mowing a lawn. And you know mowing lawns, keeping all of these straight lines. You're just paying attention. And then I may or may not have gotten a text and was looking at the text while my mower was going. And I look back, and that was the worst line of my life. It didn't look good because I did not keep before me the importance of the straight path. Or perhaps the illustration of boxing, right? Rule number one, I don't know much of anything about boxing, but I know that you protect yourself at all times, right? Because even when somebody's winning the fight, even when you've nearly decimated your opponent, if you're not on guard in the last round, if you're not on guard at the end, then it just takes one hit, right? You could be done. You could go from winner to loser in a moment. You go from wise to fool. There are real life examples of this, many of them, unfortunately. People who did not keep before their eyes sound wisdom and discretion. They let them depart. Namely, Solomon. He was one at the end of his life who let these things go. He did not maintain vigilance. He didn't keep the very things he called his son to keep. He let the pressure of his many wives and their affections for their deities turned his heart away from God. That was wicked and wrong of him. He should not have done so. He failed in that element of wisdom. And then I think for those of you who are kind of engaged in the broader evangelical world, we had a really good and sad example of this in this last couple weeks with a man, a preacher in Dallas named Stephen Lawson. And he was caught with a woman, and he's 73 years old and has built a persona of faithful exposition for his whole life. And what did he not do? What did he do? He let sound wisdom and discretion depart from his eyes. Even Paul himself, in 1 Corinthians 9, he says, "Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we run in a similar way for an imperishable crown. Therefore, I, Paul, he says, I run thus, not with uncertainty. Thus I fight, not as one who beats the air, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified." Paul understood the importance of keeping these things ever before him. And so be on guard, my beloved brothers and sisters, that even if today or this past week was a day where you're like walking in the ways of Yahweh, may this next week be the same. And the week after that, and the week after that, until the appointed day of death, let us walk faithfully and carefully. Constantly in the New Testament, we're called to vigilance, eyes open, sobriety, awareness, having this spiritual insight on at all times. So let us be on guard, because this life lived in faith is not purposeless, and this is not a game. This is not something that is inconsequential. It has true and eternal consequences to it. So we must be awake to the seriousness of walking in Christ. Sin, with all of its manipulation, with all of its lies, Lady Folly and her crafty and very personalized tricks, will never surpass in true benefit life lived with spiritual awareness and faithfulness to our Maker. So carry on, continue, keep these things before you. It's one of the reasons we meet weekly, to keep these things ever before us. And what's the benefit? Well, here in 23 and 24, well, 22 through 24, he describes this full blessing of personal security. So we've seen before the idea of life to your soul, grace to your neck. And what he starts to do here is he is painting a picture of the sun in his body. And he says eyes and then soul and neck and foot again in verse 26. And so he's going really from head to toe, describing this complete allegiance and complete security of that Yahweh is going to give to this individual. A little side note on verse 22 with the idea of soul and neck. The technical or physical description of soul is your throat, the inside of your neck. So I think he's using that literally. So I think probably a better way to say it would be, so they will be life to your throat and grace to your neck. But throat is intending to show the inside element of you. So he says, look, inside and outside, throat, your neck, this gives life and grace. It adorns you. It's beautiful. It helps you to walk in a way that is upright. And then he moves right down to the feet, and he talks about this path, again, the walk of the Christian, the walk of the one who serves Yahweh. And he says, you'll walk safely. That's kind of the new piece in this lecture. You walk safely, securely, confidently. Many of you are hikers or have gone on hikes in our mountains, and you know that on the path, you want to walk securely. Things are often in the way, right? Rocks and branches or roots or things that can trip you. And he's saying, I sort of lay out for you a blueprint and am even establishing each of the steps that you take so that it would be confident, comfortable, safe. So much so, and the idea of foot not stumbling is really that you don't even stub your toe. It's even minor mishaps are gone from this path. And that's talking about when you're awake, right? When you walk safely in your way, your foot won't stumble. And then when you lie down, you will not be afraid. Yes, you will lie down and your sleep will be sweet. So there's this promise of whole-bodied safety, and he gives the promise all the time. While you're up and about, while you're lying down, when you're resting, which we would acknowledge is the most vulnerable time, is it not? In fact, a lot of some of the ancient Egyptian literature, we'll get into some of the comparisons down the road and some moments that are a little more interesting. But the Egyptian ancient literature in wisdom says, son, even when you sleep, be aware. Even when you sleep, guard yourself, because that's when you're most vulnerable. There's like sort of a contrast here between what the other ancients would have said. And he says, no, no, no. God protects you in all moments. All moments are guarded by him, whether you're out and about or whether you're lying down. So all the time and then in every way. And that's really the point of the two foot will not stumble statements in verse 23 and 26, in every way. So your foot won't stumble on the path, wisdom protecting you from these minor mishaps, and then your foot will not get caught, Yahweh protecting you from great danger without, namely judgment. We'll talk about that in a moment. So the result of this promise of protection is what? That the individual is not afraid. That's the idea. You will not be afraid. And he says it two ways. Once in an indicative sense, that this just won't happen, you won't be afraid. And once in an imperative sense, do not be afraid of sudden terror. I think his purpose there, thought about this a bit this week, not 100% confident, but I think his purpose there is simply repetition, is simply driving the point home that we ought to, we may in wisdom go in confidence. Wisdom takes fear off of the table. Afraid of what? That is kind of the question. Like, what should we fear? Because wisdom allays it. Before the fear of Yahweh, fear of man, fear of judgment, fear of death, they all take flight. They all are spoken to. They're addressed in the fear of God. How does it do that? How does wisdom or the fear of God quiet the other fears? That's the first part of verse 26. Because Yahweh himself stands behind the promise of protection. So if what we're saying about the Ancient of Days is true, if he is before all things, if he does have all authority, if he's aware of everything, if even though the nations and the strongest human elements wage war against him and the strongest spiritual elements wage war against him, if they throw everything they have and he is not bothered, meaning his power is not hindered, and he promises to be our security, then we have something. Then we are able to walk in confidence and in comfort. He says here, there's an inclusio here as well. What is the son commanded to do? Keep sound wisdom. Don't let it go. Maintain it. And then what does Yahweh promise to do? Keep us. Keep our feet. He's going to maintain his word. Some of you, if you're looking, particularly if you happen to have the NIV with you, you say, for the Lord will be by your side, is an alternate translation of the Lord will be your confidence. Both are faithful. I think your confidence is a bit more interpretive. So the Lord being by your side might continue the body language that's been going on. Eyes, throat, neck, foot, by your side. This gives you the reason that your like the body of the son is protected is because God is next to him. But the implication even of him being by your side is that it gives you confidence in the walk of life. What's he keeping us from? What's so dangerous? What might we naturally be afraid of? Well, a whole variety of things, but the ones spoken in the text here are sudden terror, trouble of or from or of, I think is better, the wicked. So what are these things? Ultimately, he's keeping us from the judgment that he will express upon the wicked, which will come at an unexpected time. So sudden terror is the idea of the moment that judgment strikes. We saw that in chapter 1 with the first address from Lady Wisdom. She's calling out. She's saying, hey, listen to me, listen to me. And if you don't, then the moment that terror strikes, she sort of abandons them. She says, no. In fact, she laughs at them and mocks them. and says, no, you should have been with me. I've been calling out this whole time. And now when sudden terror strikes, now when judgment day arrives, oh, of course you want the security. Of course, now that you see, you just want out of this great peril. So the trouble from the wicked is not so much that it's something that comes upon them or just happens to them in life, and certainly not, it sort of reads that way, something that proceeds from them, meaning the dangers we experience from the wicked. No, this is their calamity, the judgment that is reserved for them. It is stored in readiness for the final day. It just needs sort of the go button to be pressed, like Peter describes. They are reserved for judgment. That's the idea. And he says, don't be afraid of sudden terror. You can sleep. You can rest. Don't be afraid. When trouble for the wicked comes, God will be your confidence, and you won't be caught in that snare. That's the first piece, is personal devotion identified by not letting these things ever go from in front of our face. And the blessing that's found in there is security, namely security at the end when calamity strikes. God will preserve us. We are safe. We walk safely through the first death and escape the second one. So part two is the examples then. How does this wisdom take life in the community? Here are a couple of examples. Then if the first piece is private devotion, this is public devotion. And it is important for us from a big picture view to remember this idea that social behavior and theology are closely intertwined. What we believe and what we do are very closely intertwined. In fact, the intention is that everything we do, all of our activities, are intended to flow out of what we believe. They're revealing about our hearts, particularly our hearts in a moment, and perhaps of our hearts in the big picture as well. And so, he says these ideas, right? Don't withhold good from those to whom it is due. Don't say to your neighbor this. Don't devise evil against your neighbor. Don't strive with a man without cause. The way this is working is a fewfold. There's two different pairs. 27 and 28 is the first pair, and then 29 and 30 is the second pair. And I suppose before we dive into those, let's consider for a moment the question, or answer the question briefly, who is our neighbor? This is another sort of Pharisee question that came from poor motives, but is a good question. If he says the two great commands are love the Lord completely and then love your neighbor as yourself, it's a good follow-up question. If we're seeking to be in line with the law, who's my neighbor? Are we talking about like all the people? Are we talking about just my next door? Which is our sort of concept, right? The person, your neighborhood, and then your next door neighbors, that kind of an idea. Well, Jesus answered that question with the parable of the Good Samaritan, and he described, you know, the man that got sort of waylaid on his trip, and he's lying beaten and having been robbed in the middle of the road, and there are people that begin to pass by him, the religious elites, and they sort of look at him and keep going. This isn't my neighbor. You know, he's a castaway. You know, I don't want anything to do with him. He's unclean. So they go their way, and then the Samaritan comes, which is someone that would be the least likely hero. And the Good Samaritan comes and he addresses the needs of the person that's there. Not because he has any sort of previous commitment to him, not because the guy called him up and texted him and said, hey, I need your help. I'm at this point, you know, so I'll drop you a pin, come get me. It's not like that. It's just he happened upon him. And so really the instruction from that parable is that your neighbor is somebody in your way. And you can take that positively or negatively, you know, like, you're in my way. But that's the idea. They're along the path. So don't think when we read neighbor, necessarily next door neighbor, though they likely are included in that category. This can range from anyone who is a very close friend, like a friend who loves at all times is a neighbor in Proverbs 17:17, to a person that you ate with one time, to a person that you said hi to. Like, those are all examples in Proverbs of neighbors. There's been a huge range of applications as we go into this. Think all of your social settings as we walk through 27 through 30. Think about how this would take life in your family. They're your neighbors. Think about how this would take life in your religious family, the church. Think about how this would take life at work, these people that you rub shoulders with. You're both, the people that you're working alongside, as well as the people that perhaps come into the shop, the people that you interact with, customers and such. This would also take life on the road, right? People that you're driving past. This takes life everywhere. Your neighbor, certainly. Neighborhood, all of it. All of these commands are relevant to every single one of those spheres. So it bears a bit of meditation, doesn't it? It's not like that we just, okay, so I don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. Think about all the ways you might be tempted to do that in all sorts of a variety of settings. So the first pair. Don't withhold good from those whom it is due when it is in the power of your hand to do so. Do not say to your neighbor, go and come back, and tomorrow I will give it when you have it with you. The initial sound of verse 27 is give people stuff when they ask for it. And that's a bit terrifying, isn't it? There's kind of like this idea. And this idea is alive and well in our society because the power is in the mouth of the requester. If you have something that I want and I ask for it, then you're obliged to share it with me. If you have more than I do and you won't share, then you're cruel. These are kind of ideas that our society is leaning toward embracing, and there's a really important interpretive phrase right in the middle, from those to whom it is due. So what in the world does that mean? What do you, like somebody who let you borrow something and they want it back, and you're like, no. No, it's mine. It's due to them. It's owed by them. It's owned by them. And that actually would be an illustration. Yeah, give the tool back, you know, and if you broke it, replace it, that type of an idea. Sure, that's there, but that certainly, right? It's not just, hey, you held my coat. You operated as my bank, and now I'm ready for my stuff back. You kept my stuff in security, and now I'm ready. It's more than that. It has to be. So what this actually begins to do is it opens up a window for us to see into the intended life of community that God has designed. So what is it that is owed to a neighbor? That's the question. What does your neighbor have claim on from you? And if we go back to Leviticus 19, then we have some really helpful lines here. There's moral and ceremonial laws sort of blended in 19, but I want to read starting in verse 9, a series of them. It says, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap wholly the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest, and you shall not glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather every grape from your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the stranger. I am the Lord your God. Okay, so as we start through this, just explaining this one, the field that is owned by the individual does not belong completely to them because God has commanded them essentially that the corners of their field are owned by the poor. They are obliged, they're commanded by God to generously leave something that remains. Okay, continue on. Verse 11, you shall not steal nor deal falsely nor lie to one another. You shall not swear by my name falsely nor shall you profane the name of your God. I am Yahweh. You shall not cheat your neighbor nor rob him. The wages of him who is hired shall not remain with you all night until morning. You shall not curse the deaf nor put a stumbling block before the blind, but shall fear your God. I am Yahweh. You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty. In righteousness you shall judge your neighbor. You shall not go about as a talebearer among your people, nor shall you take a stand against the life of your neighbor. I am Yahweh. You shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall rebuke your neighbor. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor and not bear sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am Yahweh. So here what we have is this description of the wise intent of God for his covenant people, for his people. This is what he's designed a wise neighborhood to look like. And what it means is, if you walk sort of through that, we owe our neighbors, they have claim on our compassion and our honesty and our truthfulness and fair wages and impartial justice, love and honor. We owe our neighbors those things. Why? I am Yahweh. God said so. So, if someone comes to you and asks for any one of those good things that they are owed, give it to them. Give freely compassion, honesty, truthfulness, fair wages, impartial justice, love, and honor. That should be the fruit of wisdom in our hearts, is fruit in the community. So there are a few exceptions to this. Evil people are no longer due these things. The sluggard in 1924, the leech in Proverbs 30:15, the pampered servant in 29:21. Neither are they good, nor do they possess a legal claim on beneficence. So think about how that might take life. When somebody comes to ask perhaps for help, for your help, for your aid, says, do it. Absolutely, I'm willing to help. And thankfully, one of the things he does throughout this entire piece is he gives some qualifications, doesn't he? All those yellow pieces are really helpful. He says, when it's in the power of your hand to do so. So, absurd illustration, right? Where, I don't know, Leanna's in labor, and she's having a baby, and there's somebody stuck by the side of the road. He's waving me down. I'm like, you know, pull over. He's asked. We got to help. He says, no, like when it's in the power of your hand to do so, when it makes sense, when it's reasonable. So be reasonable about this. Maybe you should know when it's better to ask a young, strong man for something and when it's better to ask an older, wise man for something. Maybe don't seek the greatest counsel from the younger. Or maybe don't go seek the greatest physical strength from the older. Like, ask reasonably, ask carefully, because there is this obligation. So do be careful who you ask for what. But we should have a prepared spirit to give. We should be ready and poised to love the people around us, ready to give and serve reasonably today. And then he sort of qualifies it with 28 again, and he just addresses a nuanced element of it and one that's common to us. I think that's why he addresses it, is he addresses the delay that a lot of times we like to do. So if somebody comes to you and is like, hey, would you be willing to help me do this? Or hey, could I have this? Or hey, I need your help with this. And you say, yeah, I could do it today, but I don't really feel like doing it today. How about tomorrow? Could we arrange for tomorrow? And the real reason, for the most part, that we do this type of thing is to make the person go away, is to make it stop, or make it so that we don't have to give, or give at least as much, or give when we don't really feel like it. And that's a nasty trick. That's not what Solomon's after. That's not what God is after. Possible motives there could be idleness, indifference, selfishness. Right, go, come back, and tomorrow I'll give it. When you know that you have it, you could give it to him reasonably within the power of your hand. Okay, so that's kind of principle one. So I'll let you muse on how that takes life in family, work, on the roadway, your next-door neighbor, church. Be ready to love those around you with those sort of principles. And again, I think Leviticus 19 or other examples of that are really helpful in interpreting what is due to our neighbors. Then 29 and 30 is another pair. And it's moving, it's changing a bit. We'll talk about this after we work through 29 and 30, how maybe the whole thing is moving, but don't devise evil against your neighbor. Why? Because he dwells next to you for safety's sake. He trusts you. Don't strive with a man without cause if he has done you no harm. So one thing that's not incredibly evident in this translation, but if you have a little better one, you will see translated well. Evil and harm are the same word. It's the most common word for evil in the Old Testament, ra'ah. And so evil's a good translation of it normally. I think in this case, because it's in the community sense, to interpret it a little bit more narrowly is helpful. This is anything that harms the neighbor, anything that hurts them. And he says, don't sit in your house, don't sit in your car, don't sit anywhere and make a plan of anything that's going to hurt one of these people next to you. Because again, in God's intention for community, we have to trust each other. And if you trust someone who's plotting and planning against you, then this is the supreme betrayal, isn't it? This is in many movies and many stories. It's a good element of a story, is that moment where someone that has walked next to you in life, someone that you leaned upon, someone that you depended on, you have this betrayal and they cry out, but I trusted you. I didn't think you were going to do that. And so here he says, you must respect the trust that God has designed for communities. It's an indispensable condition of community. So we must not scheme to take advantage of others. And then he says, don't strive with a man without cause if he's done you no harm, no evil. So in here we have some interesting ideas. One is that, if we condense it, he says, don't fight needlessly. That's the idea. Don't fight needlessly. Don't be looking for a battle. Don't be looking for something to go beat somebody up for. This idea of striving is fine. There's kind of a wide range of this word. In the community sense, I might like quarrel or just fight. It's sort of a verbal altercation that often leads to a legal battle. So that's the final extent of the meaning. Or if you go as specific as possible, the meaning would be like doing a lawsuit against somebody, fighting against them in the courts. Don't strive with them without cause. So once again, as we read briefly in Leviticus, and there are other places in Proverbs and throughout wisdom literature, that will say, if evil's in the camp, it can be addressed. He's not saying like, nobody ever fight anybody or nobody never take any legal recourse. He's not saying that. He's saying without a cause. So I'm going to go look for a cause. No, he says, don't look for a cause. If one hits you in the face and you have to address it, then address it. But otherwise, be at peace. Be at peace in your families. Siblings, be at peace with each other. Husbands and wives, be at peace. Don't fight needlessly. In the workplace, be at peace. If you can, as much as it lies within you, be at peace with your fellow man. So in 27 through 30, the relationship with the individual kind of tightens, I think. He goes from, or opposite, it sort of lightens. Those who have a claim, those to whom it is due, who have this obligation. And then it just goes a little bit like the neighbor, somebody around you, and then he's like anybody, a man without cause. And in another direction, the admonitions are kind of hardening in their wrongdoing. Well, I just said no. I just said or come back tomorrow. And then I'm plotting the evil, like devising it myself, and becoming the violent neighbor. So I'm not sure if this is intended implication or not, because sometimes we would see this to be true, and other times you could probably write a proverb in the opposite direction. But the less we find ourselves obligated to somebody, the more willing we may be to wound them. And it's just I don't have any relationship to them. I don't have any connection to them. I'll never see them again. Or I'll just, maybe it might give you freedom. Admittedly, the opposite could be true. Or sometimes we see, we can also tend to be the most cruel to the people that are closest to us because we can get away with it at times. Or you know them very well. You can exploit weaknesses, things like that. But I'm not sure if that's an intended implication, but I think it's a proverbial truth that sometimes, at least the less we consider ourselves obligated to somebody, the more willing we are to hurt them. And then he takes it one step further, and here's kind of a transition between part two and part three. The final command, or two commands, are don't envy the oppressor, and there he gives us a sort of a tag for the one category of people in 32 through 35, and choose, finally, a positive command, choose none of his ways. This is something that, once again, on its face, you're like, oh, I don't envy, why would I envy the oppressor? This goes back to chapter one, lecture one, the first lecture, right? Don't go with the violent man. Don't do that. Don't walk that path. The end of that path is death. But isn't it true that throughout Scripture and in our own hearts, we often end the conflict with, why do the wicked succeed? Why are they getting stuff? Why do they get to live in fullness, it looks like, now? And here we are, the exiles, the pilgrims, the people who don't have. Why is that? And it can produce in us this desire to be on their side, to be getting what they're getting, to be doing even at times what they're doing. And so envy just takes root and it produces all kinds of this sinful fruit. So easy for us to just look longingly at the apparent benefits of the worldly walk. And it would be easy, wouldn't it? It'd be so easy, and the payout would be significant. But using this double command to wrap up all of the negative commands that he's done, don't envy the oppressor and choose none of his ways, that double command emphatically warns us against taking any sort of step toward anything like his path. Avoid it meticulously to the smallest details of your life. Choose none of his ways. Never take advantage of people. Don't look at like, well, the money's right there, or if I just said, or if I just charged, or if I just did this, and I could have a little bit more. Don't do it. Even if it's baby steps in that direction, don't do it. Walk on God's path and trust that he will be your confidence and will keep your foot from stumbling and from being caught. The ones who evidently prosper today while disregarding God and his ethics, those are the ones who cannot sleep without fear. Those are the ones on whom sudden terror will fall. Risky game, isn't it? So there's the shift kind of from good and trusting neighbors all the way to the violent neighbors. Again, see lecture one. Don't envy them. A couple psalms address this, and I think this is what we'll do Wednesday night, either Psalm 73 or 37. Both of those address this issue. So we'll probably be looking there this Wednesday night. But don't go there. Don't choose his ways. This is a part of the vigilance that's back in verse 21, because it can be easy over time to maybe just adopt little things, to just begin, okay, well, this part's okay. I'll just go this far. I'll just do this. And he's saying, no, keep these things ever before you. Keep wisdom ever before you. So what's the motivation here? Why would we do these things? Why would we be wise personally, wise in community? You have the security that was addressed earlier. And now in verse 32 through 35, we have Yahweh's perspective very clearly displayed. And instead of walking through this line by line, let's just walk through it a category by category. So first, we have the fool. How does God consider the fool? What are his promises against the fool? What is his activity, his sworn activity? What is the judgment against the fool? And this is what it is. And there's so many synonyms that run through here. The perverse person is an abomination to the Lord. The curse of the Lord is on the house of the wicked. Surely he scorns the scornful. Shame shall be the legacy of fools. Line one. The perverse person is an abomination to the Lord. This abomination is not always a moral thing in Hebrew. It's something that disgusts you, something that turns your stomach, something that's just repulsive or loathsome. So not necessarily ethical. Even this is just a little detail in the text back in Genesis, but you remember that closer to the end, it was said that the Egyptians loathed shepherds. They didn't like that occupation. I thought they were just like, ugh, shepherd. You know, like that was one example of it. It's the same word here. Or Job, he is so, he says that he's so dirty, he's so filthy, that his garments even must be disgusted with him. His clothes loathe him. They're just like, oh, it turns their stomach. Sick people, right? They find food just like, no, please don't do that. It's just this sort of idea of nauseating. And God's reaction is that. He is nauseated, disgusted, repulsed by evil, by perversity. And it's not just an internal reaction, is it? It has to include his activity that follows. Otherwise, Yahweh, as one commentator said, would be relegated to the position of a spectator. He's not just looking like, ooh, I don't like that. He's going to do something about it. It includes his activity. So what does he do? The curse of the Lord is on the house of the wicked. And notice sort of the corporate elements here in line 33, the house of the wicked and the home of the just, that there is this impossibility of an individual to contain their sin and its effects to themselves. We saw that in Genesis 2. The blessing on Abraham sort of expanded to some of the people around him in his household. You see the import of leadership here and its impact on other people, that you can't keep that forest fire from going places you didn't want it to go. Can a man keep fire next to his chest and not be burned? No, the curse of the Lord is on the house of the wicked. So consider that. The idea, too, as Christians, isn't it always? We're longing for what? Well, the end of all things. We're longing for New Jerusalem. We're longing for the curse to be undone. The curse on the ground to be undone. The curse on this world to be undone. We're looking for restoration, him to actually not just like to set the bones straight and for it to heal and for us to move forward into new earth with confidence that it will never be broken again. And consider this instead, that the wicked will go into eternity with a new and eternal curse pronounced upon them. That is terrifying and horribly sad, but that would be the end of people who are living now in curse, is that you have a strong and eternal curse pronounced from God himself. Then he says in 34 that he scorns the scornful. This is very common in prophetic literature, and we saw in the Lady Wisdom's first address too, the idea of her laughing at the people who had scorned her. So here's the mocker. Remember the various categories of people? These people who have turned against Yahweh and who just sort of ridicule him mercilessly and his things and his truth and just make fun of it and want nothing to do with it and take advantage of his people. These are the oppressors. These are the violent individuals. And he says, I'm going to do the same thing to you that you have done for all of these, all this time. You've been violent, you will experience violence. You've been scornful, you will be scorned. And you're scorned by your maker. You're scorned by the one against whom you cannot argue, where there is no recourse at that point. It's done. It's over. And so he mocks and he ridicules and he laughs at his enemies in the end because they have spent the entirety of their being in opposition to him and rejecting him. And so they are rejected. And then finally, they have this legacy, a legacy or an acquisition, an earning of shame. That's their end. And it's intractable. It can't be undone. So there's the one category. That's a bit motivating, isn't it? For life in godliness, life walking with Christ. And then you have the other category, the wise. He says his secret counsel is with the upright. So rather than him like being repulsed and sort of the spitting out of his mouth kind of an idea, no, he says, actually, welcome to intimate fellowship with me. Welcome to conversation. Receive my counsel. There's like a very near language here. And when he's saying his secret counsel is with the upright, we know his words and we treasure them and he speaks to us. And there's a blessing on the home. It's another pronouncement. It's not something that's just incidental. He actually speaks blessing unto the home of the just. And then he's gracious and giving, and he continues to give and give again to those who are humble. The New Testament authors, both Peter and James, pick this up as well, and they use it as motivation in the life of the believer to walk humbly before our God. And then we receive an inheritance of glory. It's essentially referring to this kind of inalienable and therefore permanent, something that can't be undone, sharing in the possession of God himself. We receive glory, and it falls to the people on whom he gives favor, those who are wise. And so they take, and we will take, our permanent possession by right within God's family. Not that we acquired with sort of ingenuity or manipulation, not that we tricked him into, not that we earned, but here our inheritance is something that endures forever as a gift of his grace. So don't let these things depart from your eyes. Keep these things ever before you. As we think just for a moment, and we're over time here, right at the end of time, some application. From the moral perspective, this lecture is moved along with parental prohibitions. So a word to the parents. Restrictions bless and do not curse. Don't believe, as our society sometimes teaches or screams, that everything needs to be stated softly, or everything needs to be stated positively. The father here is not harsh. He's not spongy. He's just speaking the truth, and he's doing so with a strong command. But it's also accompanied with warm motivation. And so while these things aren't always required, these are just tools, right, that parents have, some of the things that they can utilize. We do observe, though, that throughout here, and accompanying a prohibition, accompanying a negative command, he also gives qualifications and motivating statements. Like without, when it's in the power of your hand to do so, when you have it with you, if he's done you no harm. Without those, some of the kids are confused. Some of us are like, wait, but what about this thing? And what about that? Like qualifying, giving some information, giving warm motivations, those are helpful things, parents. Then there's the danger, we've talked about it already, we won't go into it too much more, but the danger of starting well and losing sight of what matters. The race does not go to the one who begins, it goes to the one who finishes. The prize does not go to the one who begins the race. This is a lifelong walk, so whether you're young or whether you're old, continue, keep these things before you. From a theological perspective, we have many beautiful truths here about God. Yahweh is the one who establishes our steps. He is our security. He is by our side. He's the reason that we have the confidence that we do. It's the Ancient of Days who's promised these things. And he's not just the one who says that he'll be with us, but he's the one pronouncing judgment. He is the one who acts in judgment. And so if he says, I will keep you safe from the calamity of the wicked, we can rest in him. He also is the one who's asking us to wait in this moment on him with faith. To trust in a day where you're like, but where is the life? Where is the blessing? Why doesn't it feel like the kavod or the honor is on my neck? Where is the gracious inheritance? I'm battling with the darkness of the world and with the frustration of my path. And he says, wait on me in faith. I am the God who generously blesses my people. Then from the Christological perspective, we have to end here. We've gone there before in Proverbs. We'll go there time and time again. And that is, it would be delusional for us to think that we could be shaped by any natural means into someone described as upright, just, humble, and wise. We do not deserve this. We do not deserve the blessings that are described here. But we've established and will establish again that full blessings accompanying the full obedience of Jesus Christ are deserved for him. He deserves the secret counsel of God. He deserves blessing on his house. He deserves grace, and he deserves an inheritance of glory. And so he has, as we walk through the redemptive path, he has invited us through his atonement and through new life to participate in his obedience. So then the question might end, so then what's the point of all this stuff for us? And Paul addresses that in Romans. He says, should we continue in sin that grace abounds? He says, no. All over the New Testament. So as you've received life in him, walk in his life. So these things still stand very strongly as commands for us to do and to obey. But just always remember that the curse that we deserve has been taken by the obedient Son. Amen. his generosity. So hope this is an encouragement to you. Let's go before God in prayer.